KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second hour of Forum, we discuss obsessive compulsive disorder, which afflicts some 4 to 6 million people in the United States. Veteran newscaster Jeff Bell, who wrote a memoir on his battle with OCD, will be joining us, along with psychologist Jacqueline Persons of the San Francisco Bay Area Center for Cognitive Therapy. The hour will include your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Veteran newscaster Jeff Bell begins his memoir, Rewind, Replay, Repeat, by telling us that as best he can figure, he's logged some 8,000 hours behind a studio microphone. By page 195, he's adding up the fact that his obsessive-compulsive disorder has gone on for 5 years, included 6 therapists and 2 medications and hundreds, maybe thousands of episodes. Like some 4 to 6 million people in the United States, Jeff Bell was a sufferer of OCD, and his story is one in which he describes fear, torment, agony, and shame, but also ultimately triumph, breakthrough, and hope. He joins us for this hour, along with behavior psychologist Jackie Persons, who is one of the therapists who treated Jeff Bell. Let me welcome you, Jeff. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Should mention that he is with KCBS Radio and is the afternoon anchor there. And Jacqueline Persons is a psychologist with the San Francisco Bay Center for Cognitive Therapy and gets prominent mention in Jeff's book. Welcome, Jacqueline Persons.
Oh, thank you.
Glad to have you here as well. Well, let me get the story out for our listeners. I was saying that what's unusual maybe about Jeff's story, although it's probably not an unusual story for many people we're talking about, so many who are afflicted or who can relate in a human way to these symptoms in one form or another, but yours had a lot to do with really concern about other people. It starts with the cabin cruiser, for example.
Mm-hmm. It's sometimes called hypermorality, and I'm sure Jackie can weigh in on that as well in terms of what this particular harm obsession of mine is about. The cabin cruiser episode, to a large extent, was where everything started for me, and there was nothing special about this particular episode other than its timing, which was my late 20s. I had just become a parent. There were a lot of stressors in my life, and from what I understand, that typically will trigger the adult OCD disorder for those of us who are predisposed to have it. My obsession very quickly with this particular episode was that in the course of a little mishap with a boat backing out of the slip in Oyster Point Marina, that our boat got blown over to another set of boats. And despite the fact that some people were there to help fend me off and there was no harm, there was no damage, I began obsessing about it that night, that what if somehow I unknowingly harmed this cabin cruiser and that at some point down the road the boat would actually sink and people would die. These catastrophic thoughts about what could happen. That was the root obsession, the harm obsession there. The compulsion became to check on that. So for almost a year and a half, daily, I went back to the marina and checked my father's boat, who I had been on, and this other boat. I went to great lengths to cover my tracks so I wouldn't look like some weirdo there at the harbors, you know, walking up and down, checking the boats all the time.
But you're also replaying this in your mind.
That was the next step.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When I couldn't physically check it, i.e. when I was at work or at home, I would replay in my head the sequence as best I could recreate it in my mind. And I could do that very vividly. I could see the images. I could hear the sounds. But they were always just enough out of focus that I would want to replay them again. And that was even more debilitating than the physical checking, this mental checking, as we call it.
And you also, you mentioned this happened after the birth of your first child. After the when your wife told you she was pregnant for a second time, instead of feeling joyful, which to some extent perhaps you did, but you were obsessing about the fact that you may have had, even though you weren't exactly, I'll quote Ferlinghetti here, scattering your seed across the landscape or anything of that sort, you were nevertheless certainly putting yourself through the kind of torture about maybe I have illegitimate children out there.
Right. And in retrospect, this is a very typical pattern that I found over the years where this voice of doubt, if you will, which is not a voice, but just a strong thought in my head, always seems to hone in on the most damaging thought at that particular moment. So here I am, a new parent-to-be. I've just found out that my wife is pregnant. I'm thrilled by the prospect of becoming a father. And I get this thought in my head that, well, how can I be a good father if I've unknowingly fathered other children out there that I don't know about? Now, I will share with you, because it's necessary to understand this full story, that that would not have physically been possible. But that didn't stop me from recreating in my head every date I ever had with every date I had ever gone out with over the years, and I was consumed by that for many, many months.
And speaking about physically not possible, there was a homeless man that you thought maybe you might have injured, even though checking records and scrupulously going after data, you found out that somebody had been killed, but about three blocks away from where you thought you might have hurt someone. So again, it's as if the thought enters your mind, and then it's inexplicably something you can't vanquish or get rid of.
Right. I think this might be one of Jackie's favorite stories. I think we came to call it the bouncing body episode, Jackie. And this was where I made a left turn in at a busy intersection. And I had this this policy of tracking every pedestrian I could see in my peripheral vision while I was driving. And they were all my responsibility. So if somebody was on a sidewalk, I was potentially responsible for running that person over somehow. I mean, again, nonsensical.
Also part of the OCD.
All part of the OCD. And I do want to point out here that an obsessive compulsive is acutely and painfully aware of just how irrational their thoughts is, which obviously adds to the frustration. So I'm aware of this, but it's still my rule. I have to account for every person I can see. And I lost sight of this homeless man who was walking on a sidewalk. And later, I came to find, ironically, in my business, the news business, I hear about all kinds of unfortunate incidents. I heard about the discovery of a body many blocks away and many hours later. Well, I became obsessed that somehow this was coupled to something that I had done through my negligence. Again, that same harm obsession. And this was a real turning point for me because ultimately, I compromised my journalistic integrity and I called the coroner's office. After promising Jackie I wouldn't, by the way, I could not keep myself from making that call, and I called under the guise of being a KCBS reporter doing a story on unexplained deaths in the area, and I asked, you know, what they knew about this one, and when I heard that, it was a clear overdose and whatnot, I felt much better. I fed the cycle. My compulsion to check made me feel better. Of course, it's a what they call a negative reinforcement. I mean, it only furthers that vicious cycle of needing to check everything.
But your repertorial skills turned out to be quite positive in a sense, too, because you were, I guess, by serendipity, came across a book called Washing Hands. And later on, your own obsessive compulsive disorder include a lot of rituals like
right.
Washing hands and not shaking hands and all that. But what I was struck by was the fact that you discovered obsessive compulsive disorder on your own, did the research, actually took it to a therapist, not Jackie, but another therapist who kind of was dismissive at first of the
right.
idea. But you were right in your diagnosis, and so your, like I say, repertorial skills did you well.
They did, in fact. I was misdiagnosed twice before I met Jackie, and I was on round two of my talk therapy, which has proven not to be very effective for OCD, and Jackie can talk more about
that. We're going to talk with Jackie about that.
And at the time, I was really frustrated. The therapist was away on vacation. I went to a local bookstore. I was going through the psychology section. And as you say, this book jumped out at me with the title, The Boy Who Couldn't Stop Washing. And it was there and then at this bookstore that for the very first time in my life, I realized I wasn't alone. Other people do these crazy things. More importantly, there was a name. And most importantly, there was a treatment. Within 24 hours, I had called the OC Foundation, and they connected me with Jackie Persons, and that's when the recovery process officially began, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's talk about that recovery process with Jackie Persons. Again, she's a psychologist with the San Francisco-based Center for Cognitive Therapy. These two are linked together, that is, compulsive and obsession, or compulsions and obsessions, but they're really quite different, and maybe it's overstating perhaps what this pathology or what this problem is, in fact, isn't it? I mean, for some people it's just obsessive. For some people it is indeed compulsive.
If you meet criteria for obsessive compulsive disorder, you usually have both. There is a small number of cases where a person only has one, and if they only have one, usually it's the obsessions, and there aren't any rituals. But if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, usually you have both. You have the obsessions. Obsessions are recurrent, intrusive fear, thoughts, or images. So for Jeff, it was the fear or thought oh, I might have hit somebody in the street. The compulsion is a behavior, usually a behavior that if other people were looking at Jeff, they could see, like he's driving around the block. Sometimes it's an internal behavior, and Jeff already described some of those, reviewing the scene in his mind to try to check whether or not he actually did do something that was harmful. So the compulsion is a behavior, either an internal mental behavior or an actual physical behavior that anybody could see that the person does in order to reduce the anxiety or distress caused by the obsession.
So that's a fairly wide net when you include mental as well as physical behavior. Traditionally, when people had these kinds of disorders, they would go into, as Jeff intimated, long-term therapy and try to use talking therapy and that sort of thing. It's proven much more effective to go at the symptom and to get some kind of relief, has it not?
Well, it has, although one thing I would say, and maybe just because I'm a scientist or a professional person, I would point out a technical detail, which is it's not that the talk therapies have been shown to be ineffective. It's just that the cognitive behavioral, the more directed symptom approaches have been shown repeatedly in controlled studies to be effective. Usually the more traditional talk therapies are not studied in the sort of controlled studies that the cognitive behavior therapists typically carry out.
Yeah, well, I have a psychoanalyst friend who says the only problem with, behaviorist approaches is it's going to crop up elsewhere. If you get rid of the symptom, you're going to not get rid of the cause. And therefore...
Oh, ask him for some data. I mean, there aren't data to support that proposal.
What about the data? Is this something that afflicts more men or women? What do we know?
I was afraid you were going to ask that question. I thought, I should look up the answer to that question. Usually anxiety disorders are more common in women. OCD, I think the balance is fairly even. I see a lot of men who have OCD in addition to women.
So this kind of work with somebody who has OCD can not only include trying to get symptom relief and maybe doing behaviorist or exercise or cognitive techniques to do that, but also what might be designated as more traditional long-term therapy. I mean, Jeff, for example, transferred some feelings of his wife onto you, I noticed, in his book. He thought you were a lot like his wife.
That was a compliment, by the way.
Yes, of course. I assumed it was. But I mean,
how
important is it to get into childhood and things like that, I guess, is really the question.
Well, Jeff, maybe you could say something about that, and I could and then add. What's your experience?
My experience, and again, I don't know how typical this is, so I hate to use too broad of a brush, but the first two psychotherapists I met with, the first one I really can't even, I can't even assess because I only gave him four sessions to fix me. That was my mode at the time. But the second gal I saw was very good, I'm sure, at what she does, but we talked a great deal about my childhood, and we talked about how I felt about various things. How did I feel when the tire made a horrific noise on the pavement and I felt like I had to go back? But as I sat there describing these very narrowly defined patterns that I went through, well, what about the hand washing and what about the need to drive my car in circles? She would bring me back to, well, let's get at the underlying cause of all that. And I could just tell, my gut told me, knowing nothing about psychology, my gut told me we're barking up the wrong tree, that somehow we need to address the behavioral issues. And as I write in the book, the first time I sat down in Jackie Person's office, I was determined, and I sat down there and I said, I need to tell you something. I don't want to talk about my childhood. And Jackie smiled and said, well, I don't really want to hear about it, in so many words, at least that's how I remember it. And that she won me over with that, because I knew we were serious about honing in on the behavioral issues and the cognitive thoughts that went with them and how I could change that structure.
Jackie, you want to comment here?
Well, for me, the answer is always, what do the data say? There's not good evidence that therapies, especially the traditional therapies that do tend to focus on understanding the origins and talking about childhood, produce good results. I would say that even in a cognitive behavioral therapy that's very focused on symptoms, we did spend some time talking about childhood origins and where did this come from. And What are the current precipitants? What's triggering it now? Because part of our work involved helping Jeff and helping our patients understand what are the stressors that tend to trigger your symptoms and make them worse, and what thoughts could you have about how to manage those more effectively so that you're less vulnerable to your symptoms.
You mentioned before your scientific background. A lot of this, Jeff goes into some detail about Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA and his theories about biochemical imbalance. A lot of this is neuroscience. A lot of this is related to neurotransmitters, and consequently, we are in this era of pharmacology and greater strength through chemistry and so forth. Ultimately, it seems as if a lot of this is enigmatic. We don't know at least the real source of this. We know what the triggers might be, and we know what sets it off, and we know a lot of people suffer from it, and there's a lot of shame and stigma and so forth, but a lot of it may be neurological or related to the brain, no?
Oh, I'm certain it is. I mean, we're not angels. You know, we have bodies and we have brains and we have genes. And there's good evidence that there's a genetic basis to many anxiety disorders, including OCD. And there's data. Jeff Schwartz has produced some of it, and others have as well, showing there are brain abnormalities or brain functioning abnormalities in OCD that seem to get corrected with effective treatment. We're at the very edges of really having a good understanding of the disorder at that level.
Yeah, but Robin, my producer, even reminds me there's been some speculation about streptococcal bacteria at early age.
There is some evidence of some bacterial causes of some childhood OCDs. Apparently there's a subset of childhood OCDs that are effectively treated with antibiotics, I guess.
Well, Jeff, you were pretty resistant to medication at first when it was proposed for you.
I was extremely resistant, and part of that is a catch-22 within the OCD world, if you will. At my worst, the world was entirely black and white, no shades of gray whatsoever. And if I took pharmaceuticals for a mental health issue, I was a crazy person, and I didn't want to think of myself as a crazy person, so therefore it was out of the question that I would take any kind of medication. One other factor, too, was that I think, like a lot of obsessive compulsives, I've always obsessed about losing control of my life, and this certainly feeds that harm pattern. And my thinking was, well, if I can't trust my senses as is, and obviously I'm not trusting those if I'm going back and checking everything, if I can't trust them as is, how can I trust them on medication? I was convinced it was going to change who I was. I was convinced it was going to change, in a negative way, my abilities to process my own sensory input and so forth.
All understandable fears, too.
And I fought this for a very long time. And then ultimately I did go on medication, not for its benefit in terms of fixing me from OCD or fixing me in terms of the biophysical aspect, but to take the edge off enough that I could do the hard work with Jackie in terms of the behavioral issues.
Talking to Jeff Bell, whose memoir is called Rewind, Replay, Repeat. It's a memoir of obsessive-compulsive disorder. And Jacqueline Persons is a psychologist with the San Francisco-based Center for Cognitive Therapy. I don't know, Jeff and Jackie, how familiar you are with the television show Monk. I mentioned before the shame and stigma that's attached to OCD. A lot of folks have been offended by this Tony Shalhoub portrayal of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Some have said it's been good in the sense that maybe it's taken the edge off some of that shame and stigma. Either of you have some thoughts to offer?
I have to say I'm not a TV watcher, so certainly people talk to me about it. I should watch this show sometime so I could comment. What do you think, Jeff?
I'm in the group that thinks it's good. It's a funny show, and one of the, let me just sidetrack for just a quick second to tell you that one of the comments I'm hearing over and over again as the book is now being released is that somebody will walk up to me somewhat sheepishly and say, I don't know if this is okay to say, but this is the funniest thing I've read in a long time. Is that okay? And I think I've taken that now as the highest praise possible because I really wanted the book to be readable. And here's the thing. This stuff we OCs do, it is pretty comical. It's so nonsensical, it's off the charts. And personally, I found that as I redeveloped my sense of humor, which I lost for a lot of years, let me tell you, that became a powerful tool in gaining perspective on just what I was doing, both with my thoughts and my actions.
Well, you're right about Jackie laughing about that moving body episode, for example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I'm sitting, she helped me hear myself talk. She helped me hear myself say, well, yeah, I'm convinced that, you know, somehow this body is that of a person that I hit that somehow bounced 6 blocks and wound up with a hypodermic needle in the arm from a drug overdose. I mean, just to hear me say it, when I'm in the throes of these things, I can't have that perspective. And
yeah,
so Jackie was able to do that for me.
Of perspective. Well, the other thing is, like, I've been learning more about emotion and emotion theory, and I wonder if another reason that humor was helpful is because, if I laugh and if Jeff is able to laugh, there's a shift in his emotional state, which then probably shifts his thinking and his whole perspective, too. And, you know, we need all the tools we can get for managing the pain of this disorder.
But let's get to the cognitive side, because, that's the side of the street you work on. And Jeff was saying that you enabled him to really see both the irrationality of his thoughts and, in some respects, you know, what he was doing to himself. I mean, this essentially comes through a kind of educational or pedagogical role for you, or you bring it out from the patient, from the patients themselves?
Well, I think this example we're just talking about, where Jeff's describing the situation and I'm laughing, which, you know, I need to do carefully because I'm not there to embarrass or humiliate or shame my patients, but as a way of helping them shift perspective. Wait a minute. So you're telling me you feel like you hit this person and then somehow the body appeared 3 blocks later? Now, could you explain to me, like, how would that happen? Or, you know, I'm just kind of looking completely dumbfounded. And then Jeff has to, as he says, he has to listen to the words he's saying and the story he's telling me and the way he's thinking about it and realize in that moment that it makes completely no sense. And he's, you know, that opens up his whole world and way of thinking about things, and we need to find some other ways of thinking. And in OCD in particular, we need to find some other ways of behaving. Cognitive behavior therapy is really a better descriptor for the therapy that is most helpful to Jeff and other patients with OCD.
So, Jeff, it's conceptualizing and becoming aware and educating yourself and educating through the therapeutic process that really represents for you the turnaround?
Absolutely. Getting a framework, coming to understand how irrational these thoughts are, it helps me quite a bit. We talked a little bit about Jeff Schwartz and his research at UCLA, for example. It helps me to think of this as a biochemical brain disorder and to almost visualize the neurons misfiring. And so when I'm having this crazy thought, and with Jackie's help and now without her help, I'm able to step back and say, whoa, hang on a second here. This is an OCD thought, and it's happening because my brain's neurons are misfiring.
So they're still invading you from time to time.
Oh, sure,
you
know, sure.
There's no escaping that.
No.
But you can frame it in such a way that it casts it out, it exercises it,
right.
Expels it.
I can step back and reattribute what's going on here, as Dr. Schwartz writes. This whole notion of relabeling the obsessions for what they are and the compulsions for what they are, and then reattributing them to a medical disorder. And that's really powerful when you can stop and back up and say that.
Jackie, you're going to say something quickly because we're coming up on break.
I am, because I thought the question you asked was interesting, Michael, and I think Jeff's obtaining a diagnosis was psychoeducational thing that was a key part of his recovery. And many therapists are not offering their patients diagnoses. In this case, it was really important for Jeff to have that information.
Well, we're talking about obsessive-compulsive disorder, and we welcome your calls. You can join us now live, 866-733-6786. That's toll-free from wherever you're listening or however, on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Join us with any questions or comments you might have. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us. Our email address here is forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Thursday on Forum, in our opening hour, we talk with humorist and author P.J. O'Rourke. He has a new book out called On the Wealth of Nations. And then in the second hour, we look at career transition. Next week, Peggy Ornstein joins us to talk about fertility and infertility. We'll talk to the president of the American Association of scientists, and we'll also have an hour all about hip-hop. And let us hear from you if you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear. Questions, comments, suggestions, feedback of any kind, email us, forum@kqed.org, or call our listener call-in line. That number is 415-553-3300. And visit us on our website at www.kqed.org, and Forum is available to you now as a podcast. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jeff Bell and Jacqueline Persons. Jeff is anchor for KCBS News, the afternoon news. He's also the author of Rewind, Replay, Repeat. It's a memoir of obsessive-compulsive disorder. And he'll be at Borders Books at Union Square Tuesday, February 13th at 7 o'clock. And Jacqueline Persons with us as well. She is mentioned prominently in the book and is a therapist who works in cognitive therapy and worked with Jeff and is a psychologist with the San Francisco-based Center for Cognitive Therapy. We're going to go to your calls. And again, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call us toll-free at 866-733-6786. And Peter, you're up first. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for your show. I would imagine that transcendental meditation might be very helpful in this kind of disorder because it has the effect of refreshing the brain and kind of clearing some of the negative neurological pathways. And I wonder if there's been any research on that, or it might be a good area for research.
Well, Jacqueline Persons, it's interesting caller should mention transcendental meditation, because often with these kinds of obsessive-compulsive disorders, yoga is mentioned and relaxation exercises are mentioned. I mean, what do we know about the effects of those kinds of approaches?
I think we know anything about them. I'm not aware of any controlled studies done evaluating usefulness of those methods. Well, probably actually there's some older studies of relaxation, probably in the 60s and 70s when behavior therapists were using relaxation.
More. University of Chicago did a whole series of those tests.
Did they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And did they look at OCD?
They looked at phobias and to some extent OCD.
Yeah.
I mean, what they were able to do was, an agoraphobia, things like that. They were able to relax people, at least. Bring down the fear of fear, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, the newer approaches to fear of fear don't involve exposing people to the thing they're afraid of. And relaxation, if you're relaxed, you're not encountering your fear. And so our newer treatments, certainly for agoraphobia, panic disorder, disorders where people are afraid of fear, we teach them not to remove the fear, but to approach the fear and overcome the fear.
Jeff can attest, that can be pretty terrifying.
It is terrifying. That's the main problem with our behavioral therapies. They are really a drag.
I mean, you've got somebody who's afraid of an elevator. You want to get them in the Mark Hopkins, that outdoor elevator or something, but that's really the way that the fear is conquered. I mean, you had a great deal of anxiety over going through some of these confrontations with your fears.
Right? Oh, I did, indeed. And I'm glad the caller brought up TM. I have not done anything in that realm at all, but if I might, I might springboard from there to talk about the role that what I call practical spirituality has played in my own recovery. And really, that is just somehow coming to grips with dealing with uncertainty. Uncertainty is at the root of OCD. And for me as a checker, it was always about trying to get rid of the uncertainty. And as I came to develop over the years a framework for understanding that in my own mind there is a greater good in any situation, that was an incredibly powerful tool. And this was something that Jackie and I actually did some work with in the clinical environment as well, and maybe she can address that in a moment. But really what this was a chance for me to say, okay, the goal is not to get rid of the uncertainty, but to learn to live with it, to accept it, and to appreciate that there is this greater good, if you will. Quick case in point might be, when I get myself caught at a sink scrubbing my hands because I'm obsessed that there is some horrific set of germs on me that I'm going to harm other people with, I can say to myself, okay, listen, I can do this, and this might feel right at the moment, like I'm doing the right thing to protect other people around me by getting my hands clean. But in the greater good of the moment, if I'm stuck in the KQED bathroom doing that, I can't be on the air talking about OCD and doing what I can to raise awareness. So it's all about perspective.
Well, and it's all about cognitions, too. And notice how what Jeff did there is a cognitive shift or a cognitive change, a change in his idea about whether or not washing was useful for him to be doing at that moment.
But it sounds like there's faith behind it, faith in the greater good or faith in something that's the bulwark.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll go to more calls. Let me hear from Joe next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I had some questions for your guest about the nature of the stressors that seems to have triggered this. He mentioned he was excited about being a new parent. I wondered if there was a sleep restriction or even a sleep deprivation component. Also, was he self-medicating, if you will, with alcohol? I mean, alcohol, this sounds like a memory problem more than a obsessive-compulsive problem, and stress can really foul up memory. Anyway, Michael, I hope sometime you get Bruce McEwen on the program, because he is pretty much the grand man of stress medicine research, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you for the call. Any stressors along those lines, Jeff?
Lots of stressors, and it's a good question. Alcohol was certainly not a factor in any way, shape, or form, but in terms of stress, yeah. And sleep deprivation, I think that's something that needs to be looked at. At the time, I was working as an overnight writer for Channel 2 TV, and I was picking up as many weekend and dayside shifts for local radio stations as I could, as well as a radio reporter. Sleep was not something I was getting a lot of. I had just become a parent. I was feeling the pressure of working piecemeal in the media and trying to find a full-time job. So I'm guessing that, yes, stress was a big factor for me at that particular time.
We'll go to more calls, and we'll welcome a caller from Livermore. Leslie, good morning.
Good morning. I have a 9-year-old that I'm worried about with OCD with. I'm wondering if there's any resources that your guests can talk about locally here that might specialize with children.
Jacqueline Persons.
You know, I just met on email, so I haven't met him in person, but it sounds like a well-trained cognitive behavior therapist, expertise in anxiety disorders, you know, out in like Danville, San Ramon, something like that.
Well, that's near Livermore, yeah.
Yeah? You wanted, can I give you his name?
Does he work with children particularly? Or?
Yeah.
What's his name?
His name is Robin. I don't know how to say it. As I say, I've met him on email, but he's got good credentials. Yegana, Yeganeh. He's got an office in San Ramon, 925-984-8337. And at my center, my colleague Michael Tompkins, although I'm hesitating to give you his name and phone number because his phone already rings off the hook, because he does have this expertise, as does one of my other colleagues, Catherine Martinez. Maybe I'll give you Catherine's name, because Catherine is just coming back from maternity leave, has a little bit of time in her schedule, but one of the main problems in the Bay Area is we have too few resources, and so therapists who have expertise in treating childhood OCD, their phone rings off the hook.
Well, what are you seeing in your daughter, Leslie?
A lot of stuff you guys are talking about. Just she's anxious. She has some compulsions and some obsessions. Where at nighttime, she starts going to bed, and she starts with a bunch of questions, which she thinks will calm her down, but then it just escalates and escalates and escalates until she's worked herself up into a frenzy. Hmm. So it's,
well, good luck.
Know. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having the show, and I appreciate your guest's candidness.
Treatment is definitely a good idea, and if you can catch it early, you can alter your child's life course.
I got a question for you, Jeff. You just coughed, and of course, always being mindful of whether or not a guest in the studio here has a cough. We shook hands when you came in. I think to myself, I mean, it's automatic. It's a bit OCD, slight. You know, I think to myself, does Jeff have a cough? Am I going to get his cough? Is it going to hurt my voice?
Oh, great. You're looking to set me off, Michael.
No,
is
no,
that
no.
What you're doing?
Actually, what I'm looking to do is to ask you, when we shook hands, what your thoughts were, because you went through a whole rather ritualistic way of avoiding shaking hands for quite a period of time.
I did indeed.
So we shook hands. Well, first of all, the real question is, that's just a momentary cough, I hope, right?
I hope so.
All right. Yes. Now, but let me ask you the real question is, when you shake hands now, though, with someone, what goes through your mind?
Well, let me tell you, this is probably a good place for me to talk about where I was versus where I am today. Still coughing. Purell. Still coughing. With me everywhere.
I remember from the book, you would take Purell and you would make excuses for not shaking hands, and when you had to, the Purell was there.
I got very creative with it. In the old days, I would have found a reason not to shake your hand when I came in here. Now, I can shake your hand, but I also had to make sure that I had washed my hands prior to coming into the KQED building this morning. So, it's progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll progress to some more calls. We'll go to Windsor. June, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, my name is June Taylor, and I specialize in OCD for 18 years. I also have OCD, but my life is good because I don't ask anyone to do anything that I'm not willing to do myself. One of the biggest components in recovering from OCD is education and getting family members, people that you live with, involved in learning about OCD so that they're not pulled into the rituals, which happens so often. The mother that just called, working with her child, you know, hopefully a good therapist that understands this will be able to work with the mother so that she can stop and not be part of the rituals where it escalates. So whether it's a child or an adult, I don't work with anyone that I can't help work with their families. The other part is it also can create a diagnosis, a clinical diagnosis in family members, creating anxiety and depression, watching family members suffer from this and being pulled into this.
Well, Jackie, how important is it to go to the family or to bring the whole family involved?
Sometimes it's important and other times it isn't, but I think the point made that often the family can be drawn into participating in the rituals and feel helpless and not know what to do, those are very valid points, and family members can be a very important piece of a good treatment plan.
Here's a listener, Anthony, all the way from Barcelona, listening to us on the Internet, who asks, to what extent chronic procrastination can be considered just a symptom of OCD, or is it or will be a disorder of its own? Jackie Parsons?
I think it can be a result of the avoidance behavior or a result of the excessive ritualizing. You know, if you're spending 5 hours a day in the shower, it's hard to get anything else done.
We just brought Jeff a glass of water for that cough.
Much better, thank you.
You thinking about the bacteria on that glass when you drink it?
No, I'm actually thinking, though, that there's a little water on your console here that I'm a little concerned about here. I'll have to wipe it off before I leave.
See, it's that compassion in you again and that concern which came out in so many of your symptoms. We're going to go to more of your calls. Mary, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests could comment on the connection between OCD and autism. I have a son with Asperger's syndrome, and he's just got a ton of the obsessions and the compulsions that we deal with all day, and it seems like a lot of those kids do.
It's an important question, and Matt, one of our listeners, wants to know if there's a link between OCD and Tourette's. Jacqueline?
Well, these disorders do co-occur. So OCD can occur in the presence of autism. It can occur in the presence of Asperger's. It can occur in the presence of a tic disorder, and sometimes it's not so easy to sort out. Wait a minute, is this a symptom of Asperger's or is it a symptom of OCD? So you want a skilled clinician who's got expertise to help you sort those things out because the treatments can be different.
Also, a listener wants to know if there is a connection to general anxiety disorders and obsessive compulsive disorder.
Well, anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder is another anxiety disorder. OCD is an anxiety disorder. Anxiety disorders frequently co-occur. In fact, if you have one anxiety disorder, more likely than not, you have another one. Mood disorders frequently co-occur as well. OCD and depression, not infrequent. It's not hard to understand why.
Yeah, you know, give a plug for our friend Sam Berundis, who has written such a good book on mood disorders. Jacqueline, do you find sometimes it's tough to make a diagnosis? I mean, I can think of people being very anal who maybe don't deserve the mantle of being obsessive-compulsive.
You're saying it's just part of who they are and how they live their lives.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, they have to have their shoes a certain way, you know, in the closet, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, the question is, you know, you get a diagnosis, if that's important, if the symptoms interfere significantly with your functioning. Causing a huge amount of distress.
Here's a listener, speaking of distress, who says, I've been a sufferer of OCD for many years, though fairly mild in occurrence when compared to many who I read about. My OCD seems to be directly tied to my depression, which is the main problem I suffer from. When the depression is bad, the OCD comes out. Not uncommon, I imagine.
Jennifer. Not uncommon at all.
And here's a listener, Arthur, says, my wife suffers from OCD. She has incredibly difficult time leaving the house or turning off all the lights at the end of the night, a checker through and through. She has considered taking medications to help her through this. We're currently trying to become pregnant. Are there medications available that are compatible with pregnancy?
I'm not a psychopharmacologist, so my answer on that would not be definitive, but I believe some of the newer SSRIs can be risked in a woman who is or wants to be pregnant. But you need a top-notch psychopharmacologist to consult with on that question.
And one other email from Anne who says, the step that is most often the failing point for treatment is the failure to identify OCD in the first place. Anyone who suffers from OCD instantly recognizes his or her condition once it's presented in book form, through conversation, etc. That is why this program and others like it are so incredibly important. The book that unequivocally changed my life, Brain Lock by Jeffrey Schwartz. And you too, Jeff.
Absolutely.
Says, I've never felt more grateful for the new life given to me through the hard work facilitated by this book. It almost makes me cry thinking about it.
It's a powerful book.
You had some pretty tearful moments in your whole saga.
Oh, indeed.
And you write openly about crying, for example.
I do. And I tell you, that when I look back now, it's almost looking back at a different life, because I was in such an incredibly bad place for so many years, especially when I didn't know what was going on. As we've already discussed, the turning point was knowing what was happening, that there was a name for this, that there is help. And before I reached that point, it was a really scary place.
What a relief just to have a name.
What a relief.
To know that there are others who suffer the way you do. Jacqueline Parsons?
Well, what strikes me about it is Jeff didn't get that name from the mental health professionals he was consulting. And I know that's a controversial topic among many of my colleagues. You know, when we've got the patient in our office, should we be giving them a diagnosis? Is that a stigmatizing behavior in itself? Is it demoralizing to our patients? I think it's a complicated question. It's not the same answer for every patient, but Jeff's case is a good example where having a diagnosis changed his life in a very positive way.
Wouldn't you think it would be important to give a diagnosis if you were certain that the diagnosis was accurate, as opposed to some of those gray areas, perhaps, with diagnostic work?
There's something to be said for your point. On the other hand, in Jeff's case, I don't think there was too much doubt, but even if you're not certain as a clinician, I'm starting to think patients are entitled to have this information as informed consumers, and we need to start thinking about training our mental health professionals to provide that information to their patients. I think most mental health professionals currently do not.
But I think even if you felt it was in the best interest of the patient not to reveal a diagnosis of this sort, it would probably not be within the realm of your own professional ethics to keep it concealed, would it?
I believe you're right. I think it is a clinical issue. So, for example, if I'm holding a diagnosis that I think it would be harmful to my patient to have this information, then I do have a professional and legal and ethical way to not provide that information. But professionally and ethically, yes, patients are entitled to this information from their treating professionals as part of the process of informed consent for treatment.
Yeah, I mean, to make the analogy of the medical field, it might be in my better interest or to protect me from, you know, knowing that I have, say, a blood disease or something of that sort. But it's, I assume, the responsibility of my physician to inform me.
Yes, I agree.
We'll go to more of your calls. And by the way, if you'd like to join us, the number toll-free is 866-733-6786, or send us an email if you prefer, our email address, forum@kqed.org. Terry, morning. You're on the air. Terry? Going once for Terry. All right. I don't know where Terry went. So we'll go to Ray. Good morning, Ray.
Hi. Hey, you know, listening to this, one wonders if there might be something to be learned from sorting all this out theatrically. Has there been an effort to try to role play some of this and to maybe create a various tableau that could be recognizable for people who are experiencing this discomfort?
To help them realize, oh, that's me. I have OCD.
Yeah, or just to find out what we would find out by role-playing it, because there are things you can sort out, you know. I'm not suggesting anything analogous to, say, AA or anything, not necessarily, but just in the sense of a theatrical session with people who can guide the improvisations and to see where it goes.
Some thoughts, Jacqueline Persons?
A new idea. I never thought. The first idea that comes to my mind is I wonder if it would be helpful in the case of a couple, you know, where, because I've had couples in my office where the husband has OCD and the wife has no concept. She does not get at all what her husband's experience. Maybe if her job was to role play the experience, maybe it would help her understand it better.
Well, your wife was really pretty understanding. The problem, to some extent, was you being more upfront and revelatory with your own wife, wasn't it, Jeff?
My wife was a saint, and I wonder to this day where I'd be if she didn't hold things together for our family during the worst of this. Something that we've already touched on, and I think a caller brought this up as well, it's really important for spouses to understand what's going on, because there is a temptation for the spouse to feed the compulsion in the interest of doing what they can to help, in quotes, okay, because that doesn't help. And something that Jackie was very helpful with in terms of our family was helping my wife Samantha get a framework for when she was actually becoming part of my compulsive cycle.
Heidi, good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Dr. Heidi Hartston. I'm a friend of Jackie Person's also. And I specialize in treating OCD. And I had a couple of comments on things that came up earlier in the discussion, the gender differences.
Love to hear what you have to say, if you have some data, sure.
Sure, yeah, the gender differences, you know, in adulthood, it seems to be pretty equal, and there doesn't seem to be a difference in the kind of OCD either that women get versus men get, but the age of onset seems to be different for men versus women with OCD. So men tend to get this younger. It's not a complete 100% difference, but most men get it around, you know, grammar school age, around 6 or 7 or 8 or something like that, where women are coming up with it later, around the teens or early 20s.
And where does one find this kind of data, just out of curiosity, Heidi? The differences in gender.
Well, you can look up Swerdlow and Hartston. I did one study like that a while ago out of UCSD, but you can look it up in PubMed and find data on OCD and gender differences and age of onset and information like that.
You know, maybe this would
thank
be
you
good,
for providing that. Yeah, go ahead,
a good place to point to the OC Foundation,
yeah,
which Jeff mentioned as an important resource for him, and it's a fabulous web page that provides a ton of information for people who have OCD, for their family members, for professional people. It's at www.ocfoundation.org.
Thank you for that, and I know that will be of value to many people who want to find out more and who are suffering or know someone who is suffering. And we're talking about obsessive-compulsive disorder this hour. We're talking with Jeff Bell and Jacqueline Persons. This is Pledge Time. We elicit, we need, and we obviously welcome your support, whether you're listening to us on KQED or KQEI. And so we're going to go to Pledge, but we're going to stay with Sirius Satellite. If you're on Sirius Satellite, if you're on the phones, we'll go to your calls. And let's go to a caller, in fact, in Chicago. Bill, listening to us on Sirius, I guess. Hi.
Hi.
Morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air, Bill. Yeah.
It's 12 o'clock. I'm 55 years old. I've had OCD all my life. My grandfather had it, and my brothers and sisters, and now my nephews have it. I wanted to add a couple things. I've gone through all the thought processes that the author mentioned, and one of the most important things for me was to recognize that it was a disorder that with a name. I also wanted to, that was very helpful for me. I also wanted to ask why you're not talking about drug therapy.
Well, we touched on it. We did touch on it. And Jeff said, you know, that ultimately it was helpful, right?
The drug therapy was helpful.
Yeah. And you took what? I mean, we might as well name.
I took Prozac at first and found that Zoloft was actually a little bit more effective for me.
And Jacqueline, a caller, Bill, mentions a lot of this in his family. It does tend to run in families, doesn't
it? Yes, it does. Yeah.
Thank you, Bill. Good luck to you. And appreciate your calling us. We're going to go next to Harris. Morning.
Why, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I listen to this show all the time, and I love it.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Jeff for coming out, because the way to remove social stigma around these disorders is for people who have them to come out and not be ashamed of them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The thought and the reason I wanted to call is relevant to that. And my question is, once something is effectively treatable by a medicine and the mechanism by which the medicine works is understood, Shouldn't the disease then be renamed as a brain condition based on the misfunction? For instance, if you take selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors for depression, then maybe you should have a medical disease called hyperserotonin uptake disease.
What do you think, Jacqueline Persons?
I think it's a great concept, and I actually think it is a good idea. The problem is that we're not there yet. The recovery rate or the response rate for OCD to pharmacotherapy, 30 to 40% of patients who get pharmacotherapy respond or recover. So we've got a lot. Now, the response rate for cognitive behavior therapy is even higher, 50 to 60%. So the problem we have is we don't yet have the scientific answers that would allow us to shift from the kind of concept we have of the disorder to a name that describes the brain mechanism as pathological, because we just don't, we haven't yet found the brain mechanism, and my guess is we're probably not going to find one brain mechanism. But if we did, your solution would be fine.
And let me thank Harris for his call and welcome another caller. Peggy, morning.
Good morning. I listened to your show on OCD about 8 years ago with Dr. Michael Tompkins, and recognized that this was an issue for me listening to your program, and called him. He took me as a patient, and I think I've had lots of improvement from his treatment, and can't say how important these kinds of programs are for people recognizing and identifying their problem as an OCD problem, and hopefully getting cognitive behavioral therapy for it, because I remember walking out of his office the first time and just sort of being in tears that I could possibly live without this constant worry that had plagued me for many years. Thank you.
Tell me your name again.
Peggy.
Peggy. Michael's my colleague, and I'm sure he'll be delighted to hear your report, and I'll pass it on to him.
I'm delighted to hear that, you know, this came about as a result of a forum program. It's always good to hear that kind of feedback. Thank you, Peggy, for that. And want to mention that OCD resources have been posted on Jeff Bell's website, which is www.rewindreplayrepeat.com. Again, that's like one word, www.rewindreplayrepeat.com. Jeff, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for this hour.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
And Jacqueline Persons, thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Again, Jacqueline Persons is a psychologist with the San Francisco-based Center for Cognitive Therapy, and Jeff Bell is the author of Rewind, Replay, Repeat, a memoir of obsessive-compulsive disorder. He's also afternoon anchor with KCBS News. He'll be at Borders Books again at Union Square Tuesday, February 13th at 7 p.m. And we're here with you every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you tomorrow. We'll be talking with P.J. O'Rourke in our opening hour tomorrow, and then we'll have an hour all about career transition. Hope you will join us for that. We do indeed appreciate your listenership. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Elsa Chang. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.